Blog Talk Radio.
For tuning in. This is Political Consciousness. I'm your host, Slick Pablo Vick. Thank you for being here with us Friday, March 24th. Thank you to James from the Sports Crib. Check out all of their programming. And let me introduce everyone to our guest tonight, James King, who is always here with us, Sean Hartness, and later on we're going to get Josh McWhorter on the line as well. Today I'm going to talk a little bit to you guys about some important news, including the FBI investigation to President Trump, including cybersecurity, the importance of it, the Gorsuch Supreme Court hearings, all these things so important to our lives. But before I get into that, a couple side notes. One, big shout-out to the Carolina Gamecocks, who are advancing to the Elite Eight, the farthest their basketball team has ever gone. Big win for South Carolina sports in general to have Clemson win the national championship and to see Gamecocks on their current run. South Carolina is doing very well, at least in something. So I'm very proud of those guys. Also, as a Lakers fan, James, what's up?
North Carolina won tonight too, right?
Okay, yeah, I guess. And being fair, UNC won as well, so I don't want to be too selective about the Carolinas, but you're right, UNC and South Carolina, big ups to them boys. Also, as a Lakers fan, Shaquille O'Neal got his own statue, and it was unveiled today, and you know, as a huge Lakers fan, Shaq and Kobe, I think the greatest 1-2 punch maybe since Trump and Pence. So I'm very excited to see Shaq get the recognition he deserves. And before we get into the things I mentioned earlier, how can we not talk about the story of the day? The reason we got up today and we drank a little bit early, Trump here getting the axe. Donald Trump teaching us the art of the L, how to lose, how not to make the deal. Instead of doing the meat and bones of government, the deal-making, the negotiations, the mediations, instead of doing all those things, he said, I'm done negotiating. Either you guys vote on it or we won't do it. And because the Republicans were 10 to 15 votes short in the House, they decided not to put it up to a vote at all, and they're going to move on to tax reform. So big shocker out there. First, let me get your opinion, Sean. Is this a win for America? Is this the first significant loss that the Trump administration's taken?
Look, I think it's a great thing that happened because obviously if you can't get enough votes, you shouldn't be voting on something. But whether it's about health care or tax reform or the military or anything that Congress is voting on, I think it's wonderful that it got axed because it further shows the issues that Congress has with political parties, the fact that they organize themselves around what the party is going to vote, Democrat or Republican or what have you, they organize themselves completely on these bases, and they don't really look at what they're doing, who it's affecting, and what it means to your average American. And so they don't know what's going on at the end of the day. They just know, am I voting yes or no? And I saw that on the state level because I worked for a while in the North Carolina House of Representatives, and the people were voting. They didn't even listen to what they were voting on. They knew the order that things were coming in. They turn around, they hit yes or no based on what everybody else around them was voting. And I think it's wonderful that now there's actually discourse going on and that they're talking amongst each other and they're saying, no, I'm not voting for this. Yes, I'm going to vote for this. And something doesn't go through that shouldn't just pass through rapidly, especially when it's something like the healthcare system in America. So I think I don't know if it's a win per se, because for me, a win is whenever political parties have basically no power and everybody votes on what they believe in as an individual and what's right for their constituents. But hey, I'll take a small win if I can.
Yeah, and what's right for the constituents is not to have 14 million people go uninsured, not to have premiums rise, not to get rid of pre-existing conditions or have surcharges for going uninsured. Those are all wins. And I think what really won the day, Sean, and I think what you're trying to get at is the outrage, the participation, the involvement of the people when they sent letters, when they went to town halls, when they talked to their politicians on the phones and on Twitter, when they told people, like, hey, we are not for this. We don't want these things, this healthcare bill to go through. That's not what's happening. I mean, we like how it is right now. So I saw a lot of senators say, or House of Representatives say, that they got 150 calls against Trump care, and they maybe got two or three calls for it. And that's really what urged them to vote no and not even capitulate on any of the contract to say, hey, you know, this isn't really going to work because we're putting ourselves at risk. If people lose their health care, we're not going to get reelected. And that's really ultimately how they think at the end of the day. But it is good to see that Obamacare is going to stay, at least for a little bit. We all know it's not perfect, okay? We can all agree on that. James and Sean, I know you guys agree on that. Can we work? Do you think, James, that they can work together, the Republicans and Democrats, to just improve what we have right now? Or do you think it's always going to be some kind of bipartisan bickering?
First of all, I'm definitely going to be the pessimist here because I don't look at this as a win for the constituents. What this is the politicians once again covering their ass. They know that in 2018 we have what is it 44 seats in the Senate and I believe over 200 in the House. I mean, it might even be more than that. But that's what these people are doing. It's not because they necessarily care what, you know, how many of their constituents called in. Or it, I mean, if that was the case, we wouldn't have the president that we have now. But that being said, when we show that we have a voice, and this was more on a bipartisan level, now, you know, and it surprises me how we can work together on some things that are beneficial to us all, but yet on the other things that are of benefit to us, they pay no attention to. For instance, what Trump care did today, and the victory by not voting it in, I believe is going to have some type of impact, not only in the president, the Supreme Court hearings, whether it be with Gorsuch or not, and I believe it's also going to reflect back on the EPA where jobs are already being cut back, and meals on wheels, other things like that. I mean, you know, I think I'm overjoyed that we didn't get this pushed down our throats. And, you know, even it seems that the Republicans backed off. But by the nature of this election, I think it's going to be even more divided between Democrats and Republicans, simply because no one knows what the Republican Party is anymore. Donald Trump has left it gutterless. It doesn't have a passion for the guy on the street. And, I think that's always going to be kind of contentious as long as we have the separation, where we have no middle class anymore. You're either rich or you're poor.
Yeah, and I think that's a big driving force as well is the thirst for money. And I was talking to somebody recently, and they work retail, okay? I used to work at Puma in Charleston. And I was talking to somebody, and they said that it was harder to sell $60, $50 Puma shoes than it is to sell $500 designer shoes. And I thought about it, that why is that the case? And it's because people who are even looking at $50 Puma shoes don't have the extra money to afford it. The people who are looking at the $300 Nike shoes, they got money to blow, so they just, you know, cop whatever they want. And that inequality, that spread of wealth is manifested in what we see every day and also in our politics. And what we're seeing is a big, big push in party over country, party over country. Look at Trey Gowdy, South Carolina representative. This was the guy who was spearheading the Benghazi hearings, trying to be the patriot with the flag and the bayonet in the other hand. And now when it comes back and the FBI director and Admiral Rogers say that, oh, there is an investigation undergoing with the Trump administration, then all of a sudden Gowdy is not as assertive or not as willing to get to the bottom of it and to be that patriot. So we're seeing not just with Trey Gowdy, but look at Devin Nunes, the head of the House Intelligence Committee. He had information that other people did not have, including the people in the Intelligence Committee, and he went straight to the Trump administration and had a conversation with them and then briefed the press before even talking to the people in his committee. I mean, that is the type of Republican face-saving tactics we're seeing. And it's all coming to fruition, and now people are saying, hey, we might need to get independent with all of this. So my question to you, Sean, you're kind of like a little bit more conservative than me. I wouldn't call you Republican. I wouldn't call you a Democrat. A little bit more conservative. Do you think that George Washington was right, this two-party system is going to be the end of us? Or do you think there's another way? Do you think these two? Do you think a party can be saved? Do you think we have good leaders out there? Maybe we can turn it all around? Or do you see things getting worse? Can we have a worse president than Trump?
Oh, goodness. Oh, your question. Oh, I love it. Well, let's start with the beginning of that. George Washington didn't advise against a two-party system. George Washington said, beware of political parties, of factions, I think was the word he used exactly. And I think he was 100% correct. That was one of the most wise statements, and it's amazing that it happened right at the beginning of the start of America, because the thing that is destroying us, and it's destroying us at a political and a societal level, and it's even seeping into our culture, is a political party. Who am I? Am I Republican? Am I Democrat? I said it 2 weeks ago, I said it last week, and I'll say it again. There is no room for a simple A or B when it comes to the things that we're talking about. You cannot say, do you prefer Republicans or Democrats? Whenever you're asking me about my health care, whether it's how much I pay per month, whether it's the type of coverage I get, whether it's the doctors I can see, or whether it's about defense, or whether it's about how much I pay in taxes, or it's whether about who builds my roads, who controls my schools. None of it can come down to A or B. I am so against parties. You can, whether it's conservative or liberal, left or right, there is no clear-cut answer. Things need to be less, it needs to be more difficult. Political parties just make things easier for everybody because they say, oh, I'm on this team. I want this team to win. Oh, I'm on this team. No, I want this one to win. Oh, I'm against you. I'm for you. Nothing's that simple in life, especially when we're talking about controlling the lives of over 300 million people. So to answer your question, yeah, I think George Washington was 100% right, and I think political parties are one of the things that are destroying us. I don't want to just look at someone and say, I don't agree with you because you're a Democrat, or I don't agree with you because you're a Republican. I want to know what you think, and I want to know what you believe. And if that slows down our government, that's fine, because then everybody will be able to clear up what they want. It might take longer, but the result will be better.
And I agree with you, Sean. I think that part of it is we're conditioned to have this competitive mentality, this team mentality, my team versus yours, my group versus yours. I mean, we are a capitalist society where the fittest, the strongest survive. So we have that dog-eat-dog mantra, and that's really the same way our politics are. So you are spot on 100%,
I
agree with you.
I'll say,
and also,
all right, dog-eat-dog competitive
farming. Before you go on your soliloquy, Sean, let me just say we do have another guest joining us, Josh McWhorter, man, a college buddy of Sean and I. How you doing, Josh?
What up? What's happening, guys?
Hey, Josh.
Hey, good to hear from you, brother. And I was gonna let Sean finish his thought, but I'm gonna throw you into the mix here. We're just kind of talking about political parties and how, whether it's Trump Care or the FBI investigation to Trump, we're seeing, you know, Democrats are one way, and I don't necessarily agree with everything Democrats are doing as far as voting no on everything, because not everything is terrible. You know, even the Gorsuch pick to filibuster it, that's a whole other thing. But the Republicans, saving face for each other, Nunes talking to Trump before he talked to his own committee, look at Jason Chaffetz, look at Sean Spicer saying all the things that you're saying. All the Republicans are doing whatever it takes to save themselves a little bit, but we're also seeing kind of a split there as well with the Freedom Caucus and them holding strong and not wanting Trump Care passed. Do you see a split in the Republican Party? And also, obviously there's a split in the Democratic Party. Do you see a split happening now in the Republican Party that's more pronounced and more people are starting to stand up for themselves? And also, do you see a future where there's not two political parties here in this country, Democrat and Republican? Josh, I'm coming to you with this.
All right. Well, I do think that there's definitely going to be schisms in the parties themselves. You know, that's just going to be natural. You're going to have your hardliners who want to be, you know, they want to have it all their way. Then you're going to have your more moderates who are going to, you know, they want to be more middle of the road. That's always going on, and you know, I don't see that not happening anytime soon. Especially when you have folks like the Tea Party as well who are getting involved. I think the people who are leaning a little more conservative are probably going to, they've already found out that, you know, in regards to healthcare at least, it's a lot easier said than done. I think they've definitely taken some really bad blows, especially since, you know, for some of the issues that you just brought up, Vic, where we've got Spicer, Chaffetz, Nunes, we've got all these different individuals who are clearly questionable. You know, a lot of these guys spoke out during the primaries. Now they're working with them. Some people will say, "Oh, well, they're just trying to work with them. They're getting past it." But ultimately, the name of the game is money. That's why we have these political parties. We don't have these parties because we're divided between these two ideals. Sean made a great point where it's basically all about individuals. Unfortunately, as a society, we have people by and large tend to want things to be simple. It's very simple when it can be you or me. You know, when you have that dichotomy, that paradigm is much easier to work with than varying shades of gray. But ultimately, in the end, what do you need? You need money. You know, that's been the big deal. You know, with Bernie Sanders' campaign last year, that really set a huge precedent. People didn't realize, oh, you can make it off of, I can't remember what the average is, but it was something crazy.
$1.70 like $20 or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. That's wild. That is wild. Well, then you go look at the other side, and you're seeing thousands upon thousands of dollars being bankrolled. It's gang warfare. It's really all it is. It's many nations within a nation, and you're going to always see it, especially when there's power to be won. You're always going to see power struggle. It's just a matter of right now, I think one of our biggest issues is that we have not enough representation of actual people in office. We've got a lot of lawyers and other things. I think it's about time some of the scientists start getting in there and some other things. But who knows? I mean, some people thought getting a businessman in to run the country was a great idea. So I might be way off on that assumption, thinking that scientists might make great politicians.
Yeah, and, you know, there's no answer. I don't think there's one occupation. And then, you know, this is a good question. How about this? I'll let you guys think on this for a second. If you could have one occupation, be the commander-in-chief, be the president of the United States, what occupation would you pick? And I'll go first so you guys have a little second to think. On the fly, if I could have one occupation, be the president, I would want Roger Goodell. I would want the commissioner of the NFL, because I know he knows how to play the game. he is shady, does the backdoor deals, and still stays in power somehow. He's kind of like a more milder Donald Trump, a guy who can delegate, who has unwielding power, goes unquestioned, and rules with iron fist, but at the end of the day gives us a great product, which we love, the NFL. So, Sean, let me go to you. If any occupation could be the president of the United States, what occupation do you think would do the best job?
If I had to pick one occupation to be the president, mind you, not a perfect politician, but to be the president and to take the role of a president, goodness me, it would probably have to be, I think, a small business owner. Not a large business corporate crazy man like Trump, but a small business owner, someone that understands the needs of themselves, but more importantly of their clients and everybody around them and the people who do the work for them, that have real connections to their employees and the people who make their business run, but also understand that without the people that are outside of their immediate circle, they wouldn't be able to have anything that they have. So maybe it's not a specific occupation, I know, but it's
that's
someone...
perfect. No, I think that's a good answer, Sean.
Okay.
What about you, James? James, what do you think? What occupation would you want to run the country?
Give me another minute.
Go ahead, Josh. You got something in mind?
Yeah, I kind of playing off of what Sean was going off there. I would prefer to see someone who has experience running a nonprofit or a charity, someone who knows what it's like to work on a restricted budget, and you know doesn't really have a whole lot coming in outside of what's given to them by the public. I think that would be insanely important because you know you've also got to be an advocate as well. You've got to be an advocate for the people, and you know you've got to go out there, you've got to make connections, you got to fundraise, etc. I could definitely see someone with that type of experience, you know, being in the position of, say, such as like a president and not doing too bad. You know, they, especially if, you know, with someone that comes from a charity organization and you've got to do everything with next to nothing, I think that would go a long way in helping them, especially with you have people wanting to reduce costs, you know, reduce spending versus, you know, oh, we want to drop money on infrastructure, et cetera. I think that you have an individual who's has had all of that experience and had to decide what we can do right away and what we can kind of do later. I think that would help a lot.
Yeah, and, you know, we talk about cutting spending, and our current administration is running a bill of almost $100 million a year in Secret Service funds to protect Donald Trump and his family, including the $3 million golf trips to Mar-a-Lago. So that's almost $500 million for a 4-year tenure. So if we're talking about fiscal responsibility and cutting costs, how are we going to cut Meals on Wheels and this dude's doing $3 million golf trips? That's just one thing I want to say. James, you got anything yet, or can we wait on it and you interject?
No,
already?
You know, this will probably sound very strange. But I would pick either someone that, you know, was in the music business, such as a big producer, or, you know, as someone mentioned before, you know, some type of maybe someone like a Pete Carroll, for instance, you know. Someone like
yeah.
that.
I like Bruce Arians.
Not necessarily a Buddy Ryan, but you know, even you know, a Bill Belichick, but someone that's used to working under not only the pressure of a deadline, but they have a budget, they have to take in personnel considerations, you know, and different things like that. Now, you know, I know. You know, in an idyllic world, we all say, you know, we want the little man to succeed and stuff like that. You know, it kind of takes me back to a point that you made, Vic, but you kind of made it incorrectly. When you were talking about the guy that buys the $50 Reeboks and the guys that buy the $300 or $400, $500 shoes, usually the guy that buys Reeboks, the $50 Reeboks, is the guy that has a bank account, he has something, you know, he has a good job, he realizes he has certain values, you know, he's generally a family type person. The guys that go for the $500 shoes are the guys that they're existing on a welfare check or whatever, they can steal, or, you know, or they're trying to make an impression in the neighborhood. You know, look at Ice-T and Ice Cube and those guys. I mean, you don't see these guys walking around in Versace and Christian Dior and stuff like that. I mean, you know, they wear what they were accustomed to wear. And if you look around the hood, you know, this is what you see. You see the kids with the gold chains that are putting the green rings around their neck. You see them, you know, you see them with all the CDs. Well, that was back in the day. I guess now, you know, they download them all to their computer and whatnot, you know. But, it's the little man that keeps the crab mentality of, you know, if I can't advance, then why should I let you? And that's the reason why we have such diverse or combustible, I guess is another word, lower class, because you don't carry the same values as those that are usually on a more even keel, because they have a better education, they know what to invest their money in, they know how to make the investments, they know how to go and get an education where, you know, the other guy, instead of going to school, he wants to hang out on the corner. And you know, I'm not picking out any particular race. I'm picking out a class, though. I'm picking out a class of people that seem, like I said, to have that crab mentality that, you know, if we're going to struggle, we're all going to struggle together instead of letting one succeed and pull the rest of us up.
Yeah, and I know you're living on the West Coast, so that's a little bit more prevalent than where I'm living, you know, which is kind of a utopia that's not really the real world. So you're absolutely right, and thank you for correcting me on that. Anyway, going on to the next topic, I know we have Josh here. Josh, can you just explain a little bit the importance of cybersecurity and what we can do to protect ourselves from people watching us do naughty things and having us put stickers on our laptops and our TVs and our microwaves?
Why, certainly. Just to kind of give my area of expertise, I'm a security operations center manager for a cybersecurity company here based out of Charleston. We mitigate fraud attacks and all kinds of other things, reverse engineering malware and all that fun stuff. We have some contacts in the FBI. I've been able to be privy to things. I happen to know the day after the Orlando shooting that the individual that was there and, you know, put everyone up, that he had actually been a regular at the club and a few other things as well. A lot of people have kind of brushed off the importance of cybersecurity. With the Democratic National Convention, with that hack going on, as well as the Podesta emails being hacked, I think that people are paying a little more attention. Just to make it clear, if you don't want something on the internet, don't jack in. I mean, that's the bottom line. Don't jack in, and then on top of that, you might want to just get off the grid, because cell phones have the internet now, so you'll end up on YouTube regardless. There's a lot that can be done to browse safely. In fact, especially now with the Congress allowing your ISP to sell your browsing history to advertising agents without your consent. So just to give you guys a heads up, if you're looking at things you don't want people to know about, you should probably not do that anymore just because your ISP is going to sell it off to some advertiser and you're going to start getting advertisers for it. That was something that wasn't allowed before because of net neutrality. But because of the quote unquote, we need a free market with less, you know, less regulation. We want to be able to do stuff like this. There's ways to, however, get about this. One method is to just get a VPN. It's essentially like you're think of it as you're connecting to another network, and then you're connecting into the net, into the internet through there. You can get the Tor browser. The Tor browser is excellent. Same principle, but you're encrypting the information, and it's bouncing off of several different nodes before finally getting to its destination.
You're going to have issues like slowdown and maybe having IP blocking from different websites and such, but it will at the very least allow you the privacy that you used to have.
You know, a lot of people, when they hear Tor, they're like, oh, that's what pedophiles use. No, it's not. You know who uses it? Reporters, researchers, people in the White House that are sending it, that are leaking information, they use Tor. There's
and Josh, I got a question.
You can also do. What's up?
Josh, I got a question about the leaks, okay?
Sure.
I mean, how do we know what to believe? I mean, how do we know that a leak isn't just some artificial... You know, this is something that the American politicians use sometimes. Back when Mitt Romney was running his political campaign, there was a quote-unquote leak that said, oh, Mitt Romney was discussing policy while drinking beers and eating pizza. And it was just purposefully put out by them to make the guy look more relatable, okay? So using in today's context, how do we know what is truly a leak and what is real information? And also, what is fabricated by the administration or by Russia to serve their own purpose? How do we know?
So how do we determine fake news? There's plenty of methods. One simple method is you look at where the news is coming from. If someone's sharing, if it's coming from a meme on social media, it's going to be questionable. It might say, it's probably going to say something you want or don't want, but you can go verify it very quickly. We have the Googles. You go type it in. Snopes.com is a great one. PolitiFact is another. There are plenty of fact-checking websites out there, and
websites like this ProPublica. These are actually websites where whistleblowers leak information to. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. That's where the Panama Papers went through. There's a lot of different methods. I mean, you just have to be vigilant, though. It ultimately comes down to you have to have the gumption and the bravery to find out information that might not be true that you want to be true or the opposite. You just have to go out and look it up. You can't just take it all at face value. People will ridicule you and be like, oh, you know, if you're taking that as advice, you know, I got some ice cubes to sell to an Eskimo. Well, if you're sharing stuff like, you know, oh, Pizzagate happened, then guess what? You're going to have some dipshit who's going to go investigate themselves who's going to go, I'm going to have a gun and I'm going to, you know, fire this gun off and you guys are taking, you know. And don't get me wrong.
And that actually happened.
The best intention.
That actually happened.
And you know what? This is something I've been trying to do since the election, and I know there's a lot of talking at one another throughout the election. There was a lot of attacking one another based off of who they were going to vote for, or who they weren't voting for, et cetera. I apologize. I'm losing my train of thought here. I'm taking care of a thousand things at once.
No, you're good, because that is something I do want to talk about. And, you know, Sean, talking to guys like Sean and some of my other friends, who are a little bit more conservative than me, I try to be a little bit more careful about how I speak and the words I use and not being confrontational, because you're absolutely right, Josh, that we can't be talking at one another. We have to be able to communicate, and we can't let the political parties divide us, because really they're the ones who are creating this divide. If we talk to each other the right way, I got into an argument with this guy who's a huge Trump supporter. But we agreed both that it's good the FBI is investigating Trump in case there is some kind of, you know, meddling there. And he said, I agree with everything Trump's doing. I disagree with him on this Russia connection. So, you know, Vic, I think you're right. And I was like, okay, even though you agree with everything else this guy's doing and I can't say the same, at least we have that one thing in common. So I urge everybody, if you can find one common thread to talk to somebody who believes in this Trump nightmare – to use it and to maybe use that bridge to bring them to light a little bit, get them to accept reality, because the facts are the facts. Sean, you got anything, any input on this?
I mean, it's like I was saying earlier. I'm completely against political parties. So if you want to say find common ground with every single person, that's politics for me. That's what we need to make.
But I mean, it's
our
the reality. I mean, we have political parties.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that they're a good thing, though, and it doesn't mean that they have to be around forever. I mean, it doesn't have to be taken as a given. It's something that has become normal. It's something that we have to help us function right now, but it doesn't mean that it's a necessity. I think the necessity has been forgotten. I think the necessity is talking to one another, like you're saying, understanding what I need, what you need, and what's the common ground. Where can we meet? So you ask me, what do I think about people being able to talk to each other? I say that as long as there's political parties controlling us, I don't think we're going to talk to each other. We're going to talk at each other because we're divided between Party A and Party B.
Yeah, I disagree there.
Excuse me, gentlemen. Can I ask a question here? If you want to, I mean, get rid of the political parties and that is all right, but when is it the first thing that we have to get rid of before we get rid of the political parties is the Electoral College? I mean, look at, you know, we've given them more power than the parties have.
And, James, that's a really fair question. I mean, the Electoral College was put into place, in my opinion, to make sure that, of course, small states aren't overwhelmed when it comes to voting. There's places like New York City and Baltimore and Charleston at the time that were such central hubs and that were also very liberal that it threatened the way that people thought their vote would count. So, for example, if we went by popular vote, the argument that small states would make and the Midwest would make is that, oh, New York and California and Florida are essentially picking our president, and we don't have any say. But my argument to that would be, I live in South Carolina, so technically my vote doesn't matter in South Carolina. If I vote Democrat, pointless. My Charleston County will go blue, and the rest of South Carolina will probably be red. So that's what I would say to those states is, yeah, you're worried about the popular vote in the more liberal cities and states, but also think about Electoral College. If you are a Democrat in a red state, it's almost worthless to go out there and get your voice heard. And I hate to say that, and I know Sean and Jim are going to kill me for this, so I'm going to put a caveat on that and say that everyone should vote, and I'm going to in 2018.
No, and I think everyone should vote. I agree with you, but I also say, relating to the Electoral College, I think the Electoral College is not helping us when we have political parties like we do for the reasons that you just said, for those exact reasons, because everybody's voting one way or another. But the Electoral College is great if everybody's voting to their conscience, and there's people out there that are candidates that aren't just Republican or Democrat, then the Electoral College makes sense. But right now, with the system we have and the way things run, no, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because a president can win the election and not win the popular vote. The Electoral College isn't supposed to function like that. It's supposed to, at the most, be a close vote. It should be close. It shouldn't be a landslide, and you could still win you could still be president even though you didn't win the popular vote by 4 million votes. But whenever it comes down to really A or B, there's not a whole lot of options. So I mean, I don't like the Electoral College right now because of what we have. If we could get rid of political parties and have in my opinion, a more normal system, the Electoral College would make a lot more sense. And I think
historically it made
more sense.
Josh, any opinions on the Electoral College?
I'm actually in agreement with both James and Sean here in a way.
I believe that if the Electoral College functions properly, it can be a good thing. If the, you know, the electoral votes are, you know, disseminated based off of, you know, a percentage of the votes, you know, if we have three different candidates that got a majority of the votes, you know, we should have it divided amongst divide up the Electoral College based off of that. However, it does create an issue for, like you had mentioned earlier, Vic, we're in South Carolina. Our vote more or less doesn't count. You know, the more of us that do vote opposite of the, you know, the state, and it might not even be blue. It might be just an independent. It might be green. It could be whatever. But it has to hit a certain percentage for them to get that Electoral College vote. And you have a lot of people who are going to be discouraged, and they will vote in spite of somebody. In fact, that's what we saw a lot with both candidates this, you know, with this past election. People voting in spite of the other one. I think that a big way that would help a lot in terms of fixing the Electoral College is you have to kind of change up the campaign process, really. With the way the Electoral College is currently set up, candidates can focus their efforts in just a small section, you know, just an area of the country. Look at what Trump did. They focused on, was it Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin.
I mean, they made the rounds. You can't deny that. Trump campaigned hard. He did campaign hard. He campaigned so hard.
Well, not only did he campaign hard, though, he campaigned smart. You know, I think Kellyanne Conway even mentioned afterwards that they had targeted that area because they knew that's where they can hit Clinton hard, especially on the trade deals that her husband had done. And that single-handedly won him the election, just having that area of the country, being able to swing that. So the Electoral College also doesn't work in that manner. I think we have enough people now to be able to have a popular vote, but at the same time, I don't really believe in our education system, so a popular vote might not be a good idea right now.
And Josh, I really like that you brought up the education system, because we're coming to the end of the show, and I just want to share experience I had, and then I'll give each of you a few seconds at the end of the show to give some closing remarks. But I recently went with a professor of mine who teaches arbitration to a public elementary school right here on Sproul Avenue in North Charleston, South Carolina, public school with a highly impoverished demographic. And so I go to the school, I'm in there, and I'm in the classroom, and I'm looking around. The books on the shelves are, you know, terrible choice. Fifth grade class, you guys remember fifth grade, I'm sure. I was reading, like, Harry Potter and Magic Tree House, Berenstain Bears, Boxcar Children, you know, all these awesome books that were available to me in my public school. And here they had, you know, all these terrible books, like worse than the Scarlet Letter. I mean, the most boring books that no kids were going to touch, and none of them were touching them. And yet they all had maybe a grant to have iPads. The kids had iPads. And it just kind of struck me that the teachers were very apathetic towards them. They looked burnt out. The kids, they have iPads, but, I mean, do they even know what they're reading? Do they know what to research? And when I asked them questions about how to deal with conflict, their first answer was always violence. And so these things about the public school system are scaring me. I think these kids are being neglected. We'll touch more on this, I think, in next week's episode, because seeing this with my own eyes and seeing what the issues are with this country, I see the relation now. And with that being said, Sean, closing remarks?
I mean, You're talking about kids not reading. I think that's kind of depressing in general. Maybe they're reading on the iPad, I hope. I doubt it, but I'm just going to say, yeah, it's sad that people aren't reading. I mean, sure.
Josh, any closing remarks?
Yeah. Actually, did a couple years as a substitute teacher for Dorchester District 2, and I've got several family members that work in school districts. I'm actually very interested in this conversation about education that's going to be coming up. I think a big part of the teachers being apathetic has a lot to do with No Child Left Behind. It was a devastating law that devastated already, that schools that were already in need of, you know, funding, if these schools weren't putting out the test scores, they weren't going to get it. So I'm definitely excited for that. And to touch on the, you know, these kids have iPads now and the teachers kind of just like, eh, I'm still blown because I remember not being allowed to have a CD player or a cassette player or anything like that. That's, I mean, I'm old, so now that the kids have iPads, they have their cell phones, and they have headphones in, and you know, when I was substituting, the first thing that blew me away was that they said if they've got their headphones in and they got their heads down, leave them alone. They're not being disruptive. That was shocking to me. So.
Yep.
Let's see where that goes next week.
All right, and I appreciate everybody for tuning in. I hope everyone has a great week. Thank you to all my guests. Thank you, James, and I will see y'all next week. Appreciate
you.
You.